SBS, a world of difference. You're with NITV Radio, on mobile, online and on radio.
We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land NITV Radio broadcasts from, the Cammeraygal people and their elders past and present. We also acknowledge all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander tribes and clans we broadcast to, from the mountains to the plains, from the desert to the sea, from fresh water to salt water.
Yama, you're listening to NITV Radio. Coming up on today's program, Lisa Rehana is a Māori woman from Aotearoa, New Zealand, and a practicing artist. A new exhibition, Voyager, at Nunningalla, marking the gallery's first international project with the careered artist. And SBS's Australia Explained podcast's latest episode, What Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Land Rights. That and more coming up on NITV Radio.
Australia Day 1972 saw the first Aboriginal embassy erected outside Parliament.
The Native Title legislation must be amended.
And they've walked this land so many times before anybody came.
I am sorry.
In today's headlines, a man's been killed following an assault in Dandenong. And police in Western Australia are appealing for help to identify a baby whose body's been discovered in a stormwater drain in Perth's northern suburbs. And Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has accused Anthony Albanese of betraying Israel and abandoning Australia's Jewish community. That and more coming up in the news. A man's been killed following an assault in Dandenong. Police were called to Potter Street near a BP service station just before 5 a.m. on Tuesday morning. Emergency services found the man with serious stab wounds and treated him at the scene, but were unable to save him. Police say they have yet to establish the exact circumstances surrounding the man's death. A large area outside the service station has been cornered off. Police in Western Australia are appealing for help to identify a baby whose body was discovered in a stormwater drain in Perth's northern suburbs. Maintenance workers made the grim find during a routine check in Alexander Heights on Monday afternoon. Detectives say the baby's body appears to have been deliberately placed there rather than washed through the system. Investigators are now focused on finding the child's mother, saying her health and safety are of urgent concern and that she may need medical care. Stephen Cleal is a detective senior sergeant with the WA Police.
If you are watching, if you are listening, if you are that mother, please come forward and make yourself known to police. We would love to help you.
Police are calling on the public to provide any information or CCTV footage that could help. Australian pharmaceutical giant CSL will cut as many as 3,000 jobs and spin off its flu vaccine arm into a separate business in a bid to save $500 million. The biotechnology firm announced the shakeup at its annual financial results call, where its chief executive dismissed concerns about US tariffs, but warned about the impact of falling vaccination levels. The company, which is the third largest in Australia, also revealed its revenue rose by 5% during the last financial year, and its profit after tax grew by 14% to reach $4.6 billion AUD. Despite its rising profit, CSL Chief Executive Paul McKenzie tells investors the global pharmaceutical market had become a volatile environment and the company would need to adapt to meet its financial goals and simplify operations. Attendees at the government's Economic Reform Summit said they're optimistic after the first session in Canberra yesterday. Professor Shiro Armstrong, an economics professor from Australian National University, spoke to Sky News after attending the first session of the Economic Reform Roundtable. He told attendees that Australia shouldn't be consumed by rising protectionist trade policies, but aim at providing the certainty and confidence that is increasingly at a premium globally.
There is a lot of uncertainty, but we can take measures to reduce that uncertainty. And I think that's sort of been lost in the debate in the last few weeks. Well, working with our partners in the region, this is where we have leverage, this is where we have influence, to help keep markets open, to have a more open foreign investment regime, and thinking about ways to do that that brings certainty to investors.
He says the last thing Australia will want to do is to retaliate on tariffs, and that it's a matter of doing what's in the country's best interest that helps reduce that uncertainty and give business and investors confidence. Australia has been cautioned about the allure of artificial intelligence as the federal government turns to the technology in hopes of lifting weak productivity. Artificial intelligence will be a key topic on day two of the government's Economic Reform Roundtable, alongside regulation and competition. Treasurer Jim Chalmers has described it as a potential game changer for the economic growth and living standards. But Monash University lecturer Jathan Sadowski argues the picture is more complicated. He says AI alters how work is done but doesn't automatically make it more efficient, often creating new problems that workers must correct or compensate for. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has accused Anthony Albanese of betraying Israel and abandoning Australia's Jewish community. In a tweet from his office, Mr. Netanyahu wrote,
"History will remember Albanese for what he is, a weak politician who betrayed Israel and abandoned Australia's Jews."
The remarks came after Israel revoked visas for Australian diplomats to the Palestinian Authority, following Canberra's recognition of a Palestinian state and cancellation of an Israeli politician's visa. Simcha Rothman's visa was cancelled ahead of speaking tour in Australia, with Home Affairs Minister Tony Burke stating visitors seeking to spread division will not be allowed into Australia. Mr. Rothman had been due to meet Australia's Jewish community, which is reporting a rise in anti-Semitic attacks since the Gaza war began nearly 2 years ago. Australian Foreign Minister Penny Wong is calling Israel's condemnation of the Prime Minister an unjustified reaction that risked deepening its diplomatic isolation. The federal government will spend $1.3 billion on a new counter-drone measure over the next decade, and the technology is expected to be deployed when Brisbane hosts the Olympic Games in 2032. Defence Industry Minister Pat Conroy says the counter-drone acquisitions will be part of the Australian Defence Force's Project Land 156, looking to fast-track the technology's integration into service.
The government will announce further counter-drone acquisitions in the near future as part of Land 156, including contracts for a system integration partner for the continuous delivery of counter-drone capability. This will include command and control capability and advanced counter-drone sensors and effectors, giving the ADF more options to protect Australian defence bases.
He says Australia is working closely with Boeing Defence Australia to ensure they take advantage of any export opportunities in hopes of enhancing the skill base created in the groundbreaking technology in Queensland. Employers are being urged to end the gender pay gap by addressing segregation and workplace discrimination, as data reveals it could still take more than 20 years to close the gap. Equal Pay Day on August 19th marks the 50 additional days women must work on average to earn the same amount their male colleagues had by the end of the financial year. Research by the Workplace Gender Equality Agency found the gap is driven by three main factors: gender segregation of occupations and industries, unequal distribution of caring and family responsibilities, and workplace discrimination. Thousands of people have used the agency's pay calculator to work out their equal pay date at their employer. More than 8 in 10 Australian employers, 84.7%, have an average gender pay gaps outside the target range of plus or minus 5%. The new Tasmanian Parliament has sat for the first time on Tuesday after an early election prompted by the collapse of the previous minority government in a vote of no confidence. The session was dominated by another no-confidence debate as opposition Labor leader Dean Winter put a motion of no confidence in Jeremy Rockcliffe and his government. Mr. Winter is expected to lose the motion with five Green MPs along with several members of the 11-member crossbench already indicated they will not support it.
We are here because the 51st Parliament had no confidence in the Rockcliffe Liberal government, and this Parliament should have no more confidence. This is a Liberal budget disaster.
Speaking in Parliament, Tasmanian Premier Jeremy Rockcliffe says Mr. Winter listens to nobody but his closest advisers.
Labor recorded their lowest vote since 1903. There was clearly a lesson in that. But rather than accepting and listening to the will of the people, it would appear that the Leader of the Opposition listened to nobody but his closest advisers.
And in sport, the AFL has announced on its site that it's launched a new cultural diversity action plan for game development for 4 years until 2028. It comes as part of its commitment and vision for people across Australia to connect with Australia's game, with two key programs, AFL Community Connect and AFL School Connect. The programs are to be delivered in 21 priority local government areas in partnership with a range of community organisations, local councils and AFL clubs. It involves working directly with communities to understand their needs, break down barriers to participation, and ensuring the game authentically reflects Australia's rich cultural diversity. And now for In the News, Darwin is sunny at 26, Alice Springs is sunny at 21, Brisbane is seeing rain at 19, Cairns is cloudy at 19, Canberra seeing showers or two at 15, Sydney is having rain at 17, Albury-Wodonga is cloudy at 17, Melbourne is sunny at 18, Hobart is sunny at 17, Adelaide is sunny at 19, Perth is seeing showers at 20, and Broome is sunny at 28. That's all for the news, sport and weather. You're listening to NITV Radio. Welcome back. You're listening to NITV Radio. Coming up on the show, I speak with artist Lisa Reihana, a Māori woman from Aotearoa, New Zealand. She's having an exhibition, Voyager, at Nunangala, marking the gallery's first international project with the career artist. But first, SBS Australia's Explained podcast series is produced in 60-plus different languages, all about Australian culture, roles, laws and occurrences that are part of everyday life, but may not be common for our listeners who speak a different language or have a different social-cultural upbringing. The latest episode, though, What Are Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Rights? Have a listen. You may hear the protest chant, "What do we want? Land rights." But what does that really mean? Land is at the heart of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander identity, culture and well-being. Known as country, it includes land, waterways, skies and all living things. In this episode of Australia Explained, we explore Indigenous land rights, what they involve, which land is covered, who can make claims and the impact on First Nations communities. For many years, the connection Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples have to their land wasn't recognised. Land rights laws were created to give them legal control over traditional lands. Before colonisation, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people cared for the lands for tens of thousands of years. But colonisation took that land without any agreement, based on false idea of terra nullius, meaning land belonging to no one. The land rights movement gained attention in 1966 with the Wave Hill walk-off. Then, in 1967, a national referendum allowed the government to make laws for First Nations people. In 1976, the Aboriginal Land Rights Act was passed, the first law to recognise traditional land claims. While some states have their own land rights laws, Australia doesn't have a national law yet. This also led to the establishment of land councils to represent Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples and help manage land that's been returned. Land rights only apply to government-owned, crowned land, not private property, and can't be sold or mortgaged. It's held in a trust so First Nations people can care for their country and make decisions about it. In discussing First Nations decision-making, Dr. Virginia Marshall, a Wiradjuri Nyangba woman and water rights expert, explains the deep significance of the connections that First Nations people have with land and water.
The water speaks to us, or the trees speak to us, but we don't need to take on a Western environmental ideology and dialogue that isn't based in our understanding and our law and our understanding of our creation stories.
So let's break down something that can be a bit confusing. Land rights, native title and treaty. They're often talked about together, but each mean different things. Land rights are laws made by the government that return certain areas of land to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities. These lands are usually managed through land councils, which represent and support communities. Then there's native title. That's a legal recognition that some First Nations people still have rights to their land and waters based on their traditional laws and customs, customs that have been maintained for thousands of years. And finally, treaty. A treaty is a formal agreement between governments and First Nations peoples. It's something countries like New Zealand and Canada already have. But here in Australia, we're still working towards one. There's no national treaty, at least, not yet. Together, these approaches aim to deliver justice, recognition, and real change. Restoring land allows communities to reconnect with language, culture, and country. And it also supports things like housing, health, and economic independence. Dr. Marshall explains the significance.
Need to be self-determining, whether it's leading a committee, leading research, new ideas, forging new opportunities and partnerships in technology, and also health.
The real-life impact of land rights has been profound. The Darkinjung Local Aboriginal Land Council, founded under the New South Wales Aboriginal Land Rights Act, has become a powerful example of what land rights can achieve. Uncle Barry Duncan, a Gomeroi man, was one of the original founders of Darkinjung, which was incorporated in his parents' backyard in 1983.
It meant for me is that it brought this community together. It was a way about getting land back in the, invested back into Aboriginal ownership.
Over his lifetime, Uncle Barry has seen how land rights have enabled economic empowerment and self-determination for his community on the central coast of New South Wales. Uncle Barry explains.
I think the future now is that when the original land rights got handed down, there was a lot of talk from non-Aboriginal people about how we're going to take their backyards and, you know, claim really stuff that was said that about us that, you know, was a lot of detriment. But now people know that I think in this generation that we are very wise and smart with land holdings.
It's important to understand that giving Indigenous peoples land rights doesn't mean taking away people's homes or backyards. Land rights apply to specific areas of Crown land, government-owned land, not private property. It's about returning land to First Nations communities where there is a recognised connection, often through historical occupation or cultural significance. Despite progress, challenges remain. The process can be slow and complex, and only limited land is available. Land rights are closely tied to broader efforts for justice, reconciliation, and recognition of First Nations sovereignty. For those new to Australia, understanding land rights is a powerful step towards connecting with the country's deeper story. It's not about losing land, but about recognising and restoring a connection that has existed for over 60,000 years between First Nations people and the land. This feature, brought together by Nikaya Hutchings for Australia Explained, produced by Nari Pakai for NITV Radio.
Join the conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio.
You're listening to NITV Radio. I'm Nari Pakai and I have here award-winning Aotearoa artist Lisa Rehana. Her work, Voyager, is the first international project. Gallery Nanangala is exhibiting this coming September 6th. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, kia ora, Nari. Thank you for inviting me to share some thoughts.
Tell us about yourself. I usually say where you're from, who's your mob. So who's your whānau? Where's your iwi?
Well, kia ora for that. My iwi hails from the far north of the North Island, Ngāpuhi. It's one of the larger iwis because it was, you know, one of the first places that the ships came into and therefore colonised. But Ngāti Hine, Ngāi Tupoto, and Ngāti Aulu. So it's that's my mop on my dad's side, but I also have Welsh and English connections and Jewish through my matrilineal line.
And can you tell us, what is your creative practice? What has been your artist journey until now, bringing us to Voyager?
Well, I'm now officially 60, which is, you know, it's kind of milestone. And so I've been practicing work for a really long time. I've always kind of moved between disciplines, but essentially, I've really been interested in media work and began early on in my practice doing animation because I actually worked for some animation firms when I was younger. And I really love animation because it is that idea of enlivening something. I was doing kind of what they call stop frame animation, kind of working with like little sculptures or 2D images and filming them and kind of creating movement through that process. And so it's something that I really love, is that kind of filmmaking process, because it also has the audio. Of course, it makes sense, audio visual. But I think for cultural people, you know, it makes a space for storytelling, the oral traditions that we carry with us, and that imagery, not only of the visuals that you see, but the sounds of voice, culture, language, the instrumentation, the sounds that non-humans make in the world as well. I've pretty much followed that line a lot, but when I went through art school, I trained in sculpture, so I think it really makes sense because filmmaking is, you know, it's kind of like an ultimate type of artistic practice. You have to use all sorts of skills, whether it's script writing, talking to people, getting them involved in projects, creating the materials that you see within the screen, but then also making soundtracks. And I've always loved, I've always thought it was a really long way about me making things just to get into a sound studio. But then also presenting the works and using that as an opportunity to meet more people and learn more things. Creative practice is really about investigating a lot of Māori cultural because it was really hard for me to find when I was younger, when I was growing up. You couldn't learn Te Reo Māori at school, and that was something that I was really looking for. My father left his tribal homelands in the far north and came to Auckland. So really, I'm an urban person, and through my art practice has been a really strong way of me being able to learn about my culture, but then also to learn about other people's cultures too. So the title Voyager, we only came up with that quite recently, actually, but it really made me think about the first place that I ever travelled overseas to was to Australia. And I had an amazing time when I first came to Australia. I suppose that's when I learned to love and hate Australia. Love it in the sense that it made me see myself in stark contrast to how I understood myself in New Zealand, but also the opportunity to meet a lot of different Aboriginal communities and people and artists, and actually a whole lot of different people of many different descents, because it's a bit of a melting pot, Australia. And when I say I hate it, I know it's a bit tricky to say those things, but I think I was really quite shocked by the racism that I noticed in the 1980s. And so I have a deep-seated association and duty of care, I suppose, to Australia. For me to be showing Voyager, and any time that I come across to your island, I feel very lucky, because I'm it's always a learning opportunity, and I always meet amazing people, and you know, it's the biggest next place where I can encounter a lot of culture and art and song and dance and fashion and beautiful landscape and all of those things. So Voyager, I feel like a voyager in my own life, voyaging to learn about culture, but voyaging across the planet as well. So that's a long explanation, but I suppose it relates to being a Sagittarian, so like, which is a half woman, half horse. So I love trotting around the world. It's one of the fun things to do.
So your work, Voyager, that's going to be exhibited at Nunangulla, is a major new site-specific outdoor commission. We'll see at the entrance of it, that belong above the entrance of the gallery. Can you describe what is it that Voyager is? What should audiences expect?
Within the gallery itself, there's four or five video works that I've made in those past years, and some photographic works and a few sculptures as well. But for Voyager, there's a new commission, and I feel really excited. I'm adorning the entrance of the gallery, Nunangulla, with a work called Belong. And Belong is just it's a glistening, shimmering artwork that is made out of lots of sequins that are to create a pattern. So as people move towards the gallery, it's kind of adorned. And in a way, it relates to the way that Māori like to wear beautiful garments. So it's taken from a tanikor pattern, something that I thought would really suit being in this place and around on the facade of the building. And I think it's going to make people feel really happy and excited to walk into the building, because it's really quite visually gorgeous. It's black, pink and orange. I think pink and orange is always a lovely colour combination. And it's going to shimmer and sort of reflect the light of the day and what's happening with the wind. And it riffs off a really large artwork that has just come down that I made for Singapore. So it was an opportunity to bring something different into the space of the gallery. And I suppose act as a beacon. It's almost going to feel like fire. It's going to feel warm and inviting. So it's, yeah, I don't even know the best way to describe it, because I won't see it until I get into Australia. It's interesting as an artist. Sometimes I'm working with different groups of organisations to create works, and everything kind of comes in and just needs to arrive and be available right at the time when the audience also gets to see the works for the first time.
You have played also a role in the direction of art in contemporary Māori art in New Zealand, with challenging biases of recorded histories and re-centering non-Western cultural identities. Why is it important that you shine this spotlight on reshaping histories?
Well, I imagine a lot of first Australian, first, you know, mob would really understand these kind of, we have these recorded histories and we've been under the thumb of British colonialism, you know, economic hardship, the ways that our lands have been taken. And so, of course, to me, that is one of the most important things, is to recenter ourselves. I've always thought, even before I even got to travel overseas, there was this term, people go, oh, I can't wait to have our big OE, you know, overseas experience. And I never felt like that. I never felt like I needed to leave New Zealand to have, you know, a really important experience, particularly because I spent a lot of my time trying to discover what it meant to be Māori in this kind of urban environment that I'd grown up in. And I think, so whenever I heard any really Māori creation stories or anything to do with my history that was very hard to find in the 70s and the 80s, that became very important to me. But as a woman, I was really looking at, well, where are the women's stories? You know, a lot of, I hate the word myths and legends, I prefer creation stories or our histories. Often they have these kind of heroic figures, but we were the heroines. So for me, I've really, as I've got older, learnt more, seen more, experienced more opportunities and been invited into different mobs, homelands, and heard their stories, you know, the women's stories often jump out to me, or there might be some very small aspect to a story that I find really intriguing. And so I've wanted to think about those things quite deeply and then turn them into artworks that I can share with other people. You know, I think of my artworks as just artifacts. They're ideas and propositions. But when you put something into the world, you know, like a physical object, and whether that's, you know, a video or a sculpture, you've got something to talk around. It becomes a kind of a talking point. And when you have that, whether somebody likes what you've done or doesn't, you know, it gives you an opportunity to kind of discuss things. And then that becomes a real incredible opportunity to learn more. So for me, I've always been delving into our histories, creating opportunities to hear our language and really find a way that really supports, you know, the next generation, so they can feel really empowered and excited by all our knowledge, our histories and our knowledge, because we need to do that. In the 80s, I thought we were going to be in a better place than we are, but, you know, the politics of the current time shows us that, you know, you can't rest on your laurels. You have to be busy all the time and trying to put, I want to put really good, you know, empowering imagery out into the world.
Your artworks are quite dreamy in the way that you create spacescapes.
Yeah, I suppose also I made a large video project called Ground Loop for the opening of Sydney Modern Art Gallery of New South Wales, newer galleries. And in a way, I think of my work as quite dreamy, but it is still political. And I feel that, you know, it was a really kind of setting something in the future. And it's like some people need to have an idea of what the future could potentially look like in order to move towards it. And so, you know, there is a dreamy aspect to the works, but I think, you know, I know that dream time is a very old-fashioned word that wouldn't be thrown around so much in Australia anymore. I find that a lot of inspiration happens, you know, at night. It is a dreamy space that I go into, and it is when I'm thinking about what is it that I would like to birth into the world and share with the world. A recent work is quite tough. I've been looking at, you know, the fentanyl crisis, the opioid crisis, having seen it quite up close and dangerous when I was recently in Canada. So I wanted to use some of our mythical creatures creatures who are used as warnings to be careful and how to keep yourself safe. I wanted to use this kind of dreamy space as a reminder of really tough issues that are happening for many, many people, not just our own people, but for many people at this time when life is really tough and people find it very hard to cope with the politics, the economics of the world as it stands today. So I wanted to look deeply into our mythological creatures and use them in that kind of way.
So you'll soon be officially coming over for the exhibit of Voyager. How do you hope that you will engage with our largely Australian audiences?
Well, the first thing we're going to do is have a community day, and I want to work with, you know, meet local community, local mob. I think that's really important to me and my relationship, how I feel about Australia and working with First Australians. So that, for me, it's just like having a chat and a cup of tea and just meeting local people. I'm really excited about that. I hope that people are excited by the work that I do. I don't know. I mean, it's funny to be an artist. It's a very personal journey that you embark on to think about ideas and then spend a lot of energy and time to create something so that people can see some of your thought processes. But I, you know, I've been coming to Australia since 1988. That was the year of the bicentenary, a really important time for me to be on your land. And so it's an opportunity to strengthen friendships that I already have and potentially make some new ones. But I hope that it opens a space to people's eyes. And in the work this time, I've made a project called Gold, Lead, Wood, Coal, and I worked with Chinese community in Aotearoa, some of the first Chinese diaspora that came and settled within New Zealand. And that's to do with the gold mining. And, of course, there is those histories in Australia too. The large photographic work that I made a few years ago, I worked with Genesis Owusu and made three music videos, taking an image from that and sort of imagined a potential album cover that has never been made, but was an opportunity to, you know, show Kofi and the relationship that I had with him. And then there's also another work, Christian Louboutin, A Reverie. I worked with the French-Egyptian shoemaker. And so the title Voyager is me also extending and showing some of the works that I've done where I've collaborated with different people with different backgrounds and just to show some of the, hopefully share some of the conversations in a way through these audio-visual works that are made, and just to share that sense of an extended community and how we can talk and be with each other. Voyager, of course, like a film, comes together with the help of many, many people. So I'd really like to thank Nunangala Gallery for inviting me for this, you know, really special opportunity to share quite a large range of works. Sally Dan Cuthbert Gallery, who've been supporting me with this, developing the works and making sure they're going to be there on time. But I really want to invite local mob and anyone, if they're in the area, to come and have a look. It's a beautiful gallery, I have to say. Nunangala is an outstanding space. And there is a lovely, you know, if you can make the trip to the Southern Highlands, there is actually also a lovely cafe to have some food there too. And thank you for inviting me to share these thoughts.
I want to thank you for coming on and sharing with us today, Lisa.
Oh, look, it really is a pleasure. And it's important just to let people know what's going on. You know, there's the big news, which is always big, ugly news. And then there's the stuff that people do. And so, you know, I love that opportunity. So thank you so much, Nairi.
That was Lisa Rayhana. Her work, Voyager, is the first international project going to be shown, exhibited at the gallery Nunangala from September 6th to the 9th of November. So find a way to get there. Attendance is free. For more information, you can find that on the Nunangala website. You've been listening to NITV Radio.